on big band Broadway and beyond. Let's play a little Woody Herman to move out to segue off to the next program.
Got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I've got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go. Anytime I move my finger, lucky me, can't you see, I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let go.
Well, we have to let go now of big band music and more with Joe, your host. Thank you, Joe, for that great three-hour show. We'll be back again next Friday, folks. This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. Coming up now, our public affairs show. Local news and alternative views that you can't find anywhere else on your dial. And we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal here at WHFR.fm, the station making waves. We have another hour of information about Dearborn and the surrounding area, and our very special guest in the studio today, starting right off, is Ishmael Ahmed. Now, he should be well known to all of us in Dearborn because of his history and wonderful service to the community in many ways, but especially in being, and I may be stating it too much, as far as I'm concerned, he was the founder, the originator, the man who pulled together Access, the Arab Community Center for economic
and social services.
But in fact, Access, of course, it although began because of the great need to provide services for people coming to this country, recent immigrants 30 years ago, especially, who didn't have, they had a lot of questions about American society and language issues. But today, it has expanded so wonderfully into several areas, and it helps anybody in the community that needs help. I mean, sure, they have specialized programs for our Arab American community in language and so on. But medical health center's been open, and just one of the great new nonprofits here in this area doing a great job. Now, you chose to leave them a couple of years ago. How could you have done that? What interested you in moving up to Lansing and taking on the whole state of Michigan social services?
Well, the governor gave me a call and said, I'd like you to run the Department of Human Services. And at first, I wasn't exactly thrilled. I knew that they didn't have enough money,
right,
and that the number of people was growing exponentially. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of experience with government, and what experience I had, I didn't care much for. And so over 3 months, she convinced me, especially when she told me, if you do even a few small things that make a difference, you can help millions of people.
Yeah, that's
true. And that was true, and it remains true. And the trick is to figure out what those things are while upholding everything else. And I've tried to do that.
Right. In tight economic times, you don't want to get into a situation of being like the captain on a sinking ship, you know. But and there had to be a lot of cuts in department. I'm sure that she selected you because you're a creative problem solver. And for years, getting Access going, you had to work with very few dollars. You had to look for grants. You had to ask for donations and do benefits. And all of those things are continuing for Access, of course, and really well in the pattern that you've set up. But creative problem solving, you know, is very, very important. I don't think there's any doubt about your degree of compassion and humanity, and therefore decisions you had to make to cut budgets. I'm sure you tried to do the least harm. I'm sure that was your ultimate criteria there. You're actually here today, though, and talking about really a new pilot program. And I have the full press release in front of me, and the campaign, as they call it in the media business, to get people's attention, is something like Saving Families 101. But in fact, to step back a little bit, tell our listeners, because I'm sorry to say here, I'm well-educated, I do the show every week, I read both papers, I didn't know there was a state group or a help agency under Department of Human Services called the Family Resource Centers, and they began back in 2003. So I think what we're into today is actually a couple of things that add on and support that same sort of direction. But I know you weren't in 2003 in the office, but maybe you could tell us what exactly are the Family Resource Centers.
Well, let me start with the larger context.
Okay, you know, even larger than that. Okay.
which is the Welfare 101. We're traveling the state talking about people who receive service, and that's actually 2.5 million people. Mm. There are only 10 million people in the state of Michigan.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's a quarter of the people in the state.
One in four? Right. Where's four of us here?
That's right.
Okay, who's on welfare? Dennis is. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. We have Dennis and Amy in the studio with us, our usual co-hosts. I'll introduce them more later. Go ahead. Yeah.
So it's likely that it's a friend or a neighbor or someone who's never had assistance before receiving Medicaid or food assistance or cash assistance or child care subsidy or one of the many programs that we have. And we believe that it's important that people take a close look at this question of poverty and service, because the stereotype out there basically is that we've always had poor people, they'll always be poor. That's not something to focus on. I think one of those stereotypes is that during the war on poverty, everybody summed up big failure, you know. Yet in the first 4 years in the war on poverty, with all the mistakes that were made, poverty in America was reduced by 50%. And so when you focus on these questions and you get out the right information, you can make a difference, and you put resources in. And so we're now in a position in the state where you talked about cuts, and there have been cuts, but they really have not been major cuts, mainly because of the recovery money. Much of that has gone to hold things up.
From the federal government.
Right. Yeah. Now, we received, you know, some of that directly, but Michigan's been very quick at getting competitive recovery money as well, almost $1 billion. The problem that we now face is that by the middle of 2011 and 2012, that money will be gone and the holes will be still there, frankly, because the legislature did not step up to the structural deficit that exists in the budget. Mm-hmm. And so very difficult decisions are going to be made. And we think it's important that part of that is assuring that there's a safety net, that people are retrained, that children are protected as part of all that goes on. And some of the things that you're talking about, for instance, the family resource centers, prevention projects that we've launched, are part of the formula to do that.
Okay.
Family resource centers are centers where we take the Department of Human Services and we put it in a school.
Mm-hmm.
So our aim is not just to provide service to people or easier access to service, but actually to help children, you know, come to school, to be involved, to get the parents involved. And in the schools that we have them, and there are now 49 of them, and we'd like to grow them even more before I leave anyway, The results are that truancy is down in those schools. Grades are up in those schools. Now, it's not a silver bullet by a long shot, but we're seeing real movement as a result of that.
Where are most of those family resource centers located? Is it obviously it's not exactly these are chosen maybe because of areas of greatest need?
Greatest need, and also the support of local funders.
A
lot of the foundation community has stepped up to help us with that. Detroit has the largest concentration, but they tend to be cosmopolitan areas throughout the state where there is a concentration of poverty and difficulty in the schools. We've chosen to do it that way, but there are family resource centers in places like Traverse City, and you know, because they're rural poor too.
Right. Now, typically, there in the press release it indicated that there the counseling person or the team who is the center of the family resource centers, they're located. They actually have the office in the elementary or middle school.
That's correct.
Okay. But, you know, I hate to flash back to decades ago when I was in school in the Detroit area, but in those days, our high school counselors seemed to do an awful lot of that. I mean, we had, like, mandatory counseling sessions in those days to find out about our, not just guidance, career guidance, but testing, not just academic, but aptitude testing, and even counseling about how much we're working maybe during our high school days, you know, and other family problems. It just seemed to go on a lot. And I went to a little Flat Rock High School at the southern edge of Wayne County. My graduating class was only 110 people, so it wasn't like we had a huge facility. Although, as my daughter was growing older, and she graduated from Etzel Ford High School in the 80s, she seemed to indicate there was hardly any counselors or counseling going on there. So the Family Resource Center, was that, do you think that came about because of this gap, that the schools couldn't do this more all-encompassing kind of counseling? I mean, was that kind of it? I mean, obviously the state's programs needed to have an advocate and a facilitator that knew what was going on. But.
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple things here. One, there's certainly been a huge reduction in not only counselors, but psychologists in school, all kinds of support professions in the schools, especially the urban schools, as the dollars became tighter, in Detroit, children left, and so there just weren't as many dollars. But there is an additional advantage here because you also can feed people, you know, because we have those services, or get them health care or child care. And so you're able to take two advantages of their presence.
Right. I'm sure they didn't have that in the late 50s and early 60s when I was going to school. I mean, the state of Michigan didn't provide that. The significance of child support too here, the additional amount of money that can go to families in need really makes a difference on the outcome. I mean, you assume that the additional money to the family would go to, food, clothing, other things that would directly relate to the student's success. And not a lot of people know about how to apply for child support, even though they might receive other kinds of support. Is that one of the issues about child support?
Well, child support isn't tax money. It's money owed to you by an absent parent.
Of course it is. Yes.
And it makes up about 30% of the income of these households. And what is trying, you know, they talk a lot about deadbeat dads, but the truth is that there are a lot of dead broke dads out there too.
Yes.
And so we want to work with these parents to get that money in to help that parent find work if that's what they need. And we want to do it fast. We want to receive the check one day and have it in the hands of the family that needs it the next day. And I can tell you that we're doing that now.
Sometimes on these child support cases, I know in the past, now that I've got my terminology correct here, it could take months or years. You had to have a court hearing. And,
right.
You know, this sounds like it can help facilitate these problems and get that support back flowing again from one source or the other, I guess. The latest spin, though, actually does involve Access and several other agencies here, five urban communities, Lutheran Social Services of Michigan, Spalding for Children. I think I've heard of the Spalding. Mm-hmm. Spalding Center. Well, Spalding is a name that that has funded a lot of agencies, I think, in the Detroit area. I think there was a Spalding Library at my college when I was there. Anyway, and Access, Spectrum Child and Family Services, and the Oakland County Health Department are going to provide some of these new services, talking about child abuse and neglect prevention. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, although it doesn't mention, I was thinking, why not Wayne County? Or are they already doing something in that regard?
Actually, we've focused on a couple areas where the largest amount of complaints of abuse and neglect come from.
Again.
We get about 120,000 of those complaints and remove about 15,000 children every year. We think the best place for children are with their parents. There's no substitute for that. But when they're not safe, we're forced to remove them. And when we can't get them back to their homes, then we have to look for foster care parents and adoptive parents. And by the way, I'd like to make a plug here.
Yeah.
There's a real need for these kinds of folks to step up. Foster care parents are actually also remunerated, but this is an opportunity for people to bring children who need love into their homes, whether through foster care or adoption. We just don't have enough of those. But the goal, again, is to keep these young people out of state care. And the way to do that is through prevention. Right now, the whole system is upside down. The Fed, the state fund juvenile justice, kids in jail, basically.
Mm-hmm.
They fund foster care and adoption activities and institutionalization. We think that they should fund prevention. We should be able to go in to a home and turn things around with intensive casework, mental health support, drug abuse support. A lot of children are removed because they are, in quotes, environmentally abused, which means they don't have any food in their house. And that's not really always the fault of the parent. So this intensive approach, we believe, can save the state 6-1. But more important, it saves children and children's lives and the way they end up living. So we identified five areas. The Detroit area, it's the Osborne community, Southwest Detroit, and East Dearborn. Flint, the city of Flint, the city of Pontiac, and the whole county of Kent, that we are focusing in on all the children who have been brought forward to us for abuse and neglect, but who are not currently, the parents are not currently in litigation to lose their children.
Uh-huh.
And so we think by focusing there, we can keep nearly 50% of the kids out of the system. And the way to do that is to show that that's possible and it makes economic sense, so that when I leave, when the governor leaves, the next regime, no matter what it is, will look and say, that works and it saves money. We're going to continue to do it. And so in the Dearborn area, that's Access, mm-hmm. Orchard Services, and Southwest Solutions have all come together to do this work. And they've received $2 million to do it.
Our guest in the studio is Ishmael Ahmed, the former founder and director of Access, who has been serving the state of Michigan as director of human services for the last 2 years, almost 2 years now.
Actually, it's almost 3.5.
Oh, geez. But who's time counting?
I am. I'm counting down.
Every single day on the line, He knows how many days he's been there. I bet he's got the number of days. It's a tough job there, and there's so many needy people, and children especially, in Michigan. It's a major issue. Let me ask about that counseling issue. At the preventative situation, contact is made with the parents of the children, and the counseling and assistance, it's their choice, it's their option, or is it kind of mandatory? I would think it could be mandatory if there was already, as you said, litigation or some legal issues coming up like child abuse. But
it's not mandatory.
Okay.
But these are parents who face litigation soon.
Oh, and so they're looking at it in the future. So,
yeah, and so they generally are supportive of having this less invasive approach. I think it's important, you know, there were three things that I found when I came to the department. And the department's a big place. I mean, we have a $7 billion budget, 12,000 employees. It's like running the Ford Motor Company, except for it's supposed to be an engine for good and not for the bottom line.
Well, hopefully,
And so turning it into that requires, you know, that we do this kind of prevention work, that we get to kids and help them in school and so forth, that we maintain basic services. But the most important thing I think that we can do in addition to that is help people move on to meaningful work. Mm. And that's kind of the last leg of this administration and the work that I've been doing.
So there's a jobs connection here too. Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, if families can be, you know, self-sustaining in terms of income, then they can also take care of their housing and their food needs too,
right,
of course.
And what I found was we had this jobs program called JET. And now most people aren't familiar with JET, but the way JET works is we say, go to work. That's JET, pretty much. And 30% of the people who go into the JET program do go to work. You know, they go to the unemployment office and sign up, and actually they go on a computer and find a job because they want to get off assistance.
Okay.
This thing that people like assistance is pretty crazy if you know it. I've lived on food assistance.
Really?
The governor lived, and about 250 corporate leaders joined me when I first got there. Hmm. I ran out of bread. I had to decide whether I was going to get 3 or 4 slices of cheese for the week.
Oh,
that is not a way anyone likes to live. But
I think they did that in Hitler's imprisonment of the Jews in the Holocaust prisons. But they did that to torture them. That was torture the family. Here's 5 pieces of cheese for your 6 kids and wife. So you choose going to survive. But that's called torture, folks. And we want to try to get beyond that, of course, if we're a compassionate society or can ever become one.
So the answer here is literacy. Hmm. We have to teach people to read and write capably so that they can learn. Training. And subsidized employment so they have work histories. And I'm proud to say that I tried to launch this a year ago, and Henry Ford Community College was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
They helped train healthcare workers along with Access and Henry Ford Hospital and placed those workers. And they placed almost 85% of the workers.
Oh, great.
Unfortunately, the program was ended even before it finished in the classroom.
Oh.
But we've got the money back in the budget, $8.5 million, and I'm hoping to get another $8.5 million. And so we want to see Henry Ford and Access and Henry Ford Hospital get back to the business of placing low-income people through literacy, training, and subsidized employment.
We're going to be finishing up our discussion with Ishmael Ahmed here, and I wanted to ask in summary then, if people are in need of help for their children. I mean, we've already been back to school for a month and a half now. If it's an abuse issue, if it's a food or housing issue, if it's another aspect of the program or abuse issue, but it was also apparently counseling for date violence, mm-hmm. too, if that happens to come up or that becomes an issue. Interestingly, that there's expertise there, but how do they initiate that? Do they find one of these centers? Do they call in themselves? If they either it's themselves or maybe they know someone else, but you need to get the word directly. Probably they can go on the internet somewhere, but I don't know if everybody has a computer. So they would visit or call one of these?
Well,
centers?
Let me give the internet
okay.
to address.
Let's start
first.
There, yeah.
It's www.michigan.gov/DHS. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole plethora of information about the programs we've talked about, date violence, family support, all of these kinds of things, as well as the, in quotes, Campaign 101 okay. on stereotyping. You can also call your Department of Human Services office. And if you have FRC in your school, go mm-hmm. talk to people directly.
Because they're part of that, too.
Yeah. And there's several mm-hmm. information lines listed as well.
Okay. 800 numbers or 888 or something, toll-free stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, we certainly encourage people to do that. As we even find various aspects of college operation, we have financial aid for students here to attend that goes unused. Now, sometimes there's special categories, but there's actually money for people, and you don't know if you're in one of these categories or not. There's actually money available, both from the federal government and from Henry Ford Community College scholarship funds, as well as other kind of aid funds. And so if you don't look into that, and you don't get connected. Now, obviously, the FRCs, if they're in the schools, then they kind of find out from the teachers, the, mm-hmm. the principals, maybe other counselors, and then they can jump in there and offer their services that way. But just a wonderful system that, I'm sorry, I wasn't aware of, and I'm sure many other people in Dearborn were not aware of. So we really thank you for bringing it to our attention today here on the Journal and many other stations that you've been on, I know, in the local area and around the state, too. Obviously, you have a media relations person. Was she an intern or full-time I talked to? Christina, nice person.
Christina's new, but she's really good.
Yeah.
Nice person and... you know, tries to make sure that when I get someplace, I know what's going on and what we're going to talk about.
Let me ask, is there a place for volunteers to relate to the DHS, and I think Dearborn High School, I'm sorry, to the Department of Health, Human Services? Is there, or should that be through the schools or through Access, not directly with the Department of Human Services?
No, each DHS has a number of volunteers that actually work in the department
oh,
and make things happen. Mm-hmm. And certainly if anybody is interested, they can contact us again through the web or asking for the director of that particular office in their region.
I know there's some retired people in this area, like myself, and we'd like to give back a little to the community, and there's a lot of ways to do that, folks. You know, we do have a show called Impact once every 4 weeks where we talk about the nonprofit of the month, if you will, here at WHFR, and and one of the reasons for that is to provide people a chance to maybe volunteer and support them directly. Dennis has a question.
My question is on the new. There's a building, a DHS building on Michigan Avenue that I pass. I think it's either Dearborn Heights or Inkster, right on Michigan Avenue.
Probably Inkster. There's a brand new building going up there.
Yeah.
It's going to be named the Stanley Stewart Park. It's not only going to be DHS, but the YMCA.
That's it. That's the
and,
building. YWCA, I believe.
Right. And courthouse and a bunch of other things. A lot of our older buildings are so old, so dilapidated, and also the populations shift, so we want to be as close to people as we can.
It's amazing. It looks beautiful, too, and it'll probably replace the – I think the other one is – I want to say Hamlin, right? That's cool.
Finally, Ishmael Ahmed, again, just a hero to all of us in Dearborn for
so
Access
God.
And your work in the state of Michigan now for the last 3.5 years. Oh, my gosh. take my breath away if I had to be in Lansing for 3.5 years, struggling every day. You're going to move on, and you're going to actually come back locally to help us out through the University of Michigan Dearborn, which you're a graduate of, and I think you've been on their foundation board pretty much all along over there. Just briefly, tell us about the new job you're starting over there in January.
Well, let me say first, I'm a graduate of Henry Ford Community College.
Of course. I thought everybody was.
That's where it all starts.
That's important
to the process here.
Very much.
But yes, I am an alumni of U of M Dearborn and have been involved on their advisory board. And Dan Little, who is the head of the university, and also their new provost, Kate Davey, really are visionaries. They really believe that the university should be part of the solutions in communities, that urban problems, metropolitan problems, really need to be addressed by universities, that we shouldn't be an ivory tower. And they've asked me to come on board and help them to do that. To work with them around community service and research, and at the same time, not just have people work in the community, but maintain the academic rigor that's important, the higher thinking about these, looking at solutions, not only, you know, to go in and do the work, but to think about the work and move it forward with the people on the ground doing the work. And so they've hired me. I'll start January 3rd when we close the lights in Lansing on my administration.
Okay. Well, we look forward to having you in the community and helping all groups again, literacy is so primary. We're going to have a discussion after our break here of the new movie Waiting for Superman, which raises some interesting and controversial issues about K-12 education in this country, and it's opening in Detroit today. So we'll be talking about that here on this show and on into the future probably too, hopefully. But you'll be over there at U of MD. Just a point is that they did, I guess it's been open for a while, I'm not sure, but my granddaughter has now started, she's 2.5, but she's already started taking classes several times a week at the sort of preschool daycare facility that's next to Edsel Ford High School. What a wonderful facility. What great
Child Development Center.
Yes,
yep.
Whatever the name is. Now, is there still child care on campus, do you know, over there,
yes,
too?
There is. Yes,
okay.
There is.
So they still have that for, like, student drop-off. I mean, students, adult students have kids. They can bring them there. Of course, we do, too. But that's a wonderful outreach. I assume that their ed school must be involved in some of that. Or
yeah. This is a really good example of what I was talking about, mm-hmm. about service learning. You know, the students are engaged, but they're engaged and learning at the same time and applying that learning, not just experientially, but trying to see what else can be done to improve the outcomes. So it's a great place, a lot of visionary ideas there as well.
Yeah, well, we wish you the best. We hope to see you around here, and after you get situated, come on back on the Journal and tell us about all the new initiatives that you're into at U of MD. So,
okay.
Ishmael Ahmed,
thank you
welcome.
So much.
Thank you so much. Welcome back to your home here in Dearborn. We're going to take a break. We're going to be listening to Jim Hightower. Yeah, he's on rants today, folks, about executive pay and the billionaire's tax breaks. So take a listen, and more Journal following Jim Hightower.
Pain, no gain, say the fitness folks. But ouch, this old exercise cliche has been badly twisted by many of America's top CEOs who are getting gains from our pains. A new survey finds that corporate chieftains who inflict economic pain on the company's workers receive more financial gain for themselves. The Institute for Policy Studies examined the layoff-payoff records of America's 500 largest corporations during the past couple of years. IPS researchers report that the 50 CEOs who fired the most rank-and-file employees averaged 42% higher pay than their peers, averaging an extra $3.5 million each. One of the champions in this contest of convoluted corporate compensation was Mark Hurd. As chief executive of computer giant Hewlett-Packard, Hurd dumped 6,400 workers in 2009, a year in which he pocketed a paycheck of $24 million. Earlier this year, Hurd was forced to resign from HP after an internal investigation found that he falsified some expense reports. No need to weep for Mark, though. He was comfortably compensated for this bad turn of fortune, receiving a severance package reportedly worth $40 million. Being bad, you see, can be awfully good for a CEO's bottom line. For example, IPS documented one category of badness to goodness that is especially infuriating. 5 of the 50 leading pink slip issuers last year were also bailout barons. Among them was Kenneth Chenault, honcho of American Express, which got $3.4 billion from us taxpayers to save it from financial ruin. In gratitude, Chenault subsequently offed 4,000 employees, then helped himself to a paycheck of nearly $17 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, to see the full IPS report, go to ips-dc.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Look out, they're angry, foaming at the mouth angry, and they're lashing out, saying they won't take it anymore. As one of their leaders angrily cried, it's a war. Indeed, they're on the move to take their country back. Forget the Tea Party, rowdies, this is the Champagne Party. More precisely, it's the Dom Perignon $1,000-a-bottle champagne party, propelled by, get this, billionaires' rage. Yes, some of the richest, most pampered people on the planet, people who literally wallow in luxury every day with never a concern about losing a job, a home, health care, or getting their kids into college, these people are wailing in self-pity. They are Wall Street hedge fund operators, which essentially means they are high-flying financial flim-flammers. What has stoked them into an elitist fury is an Obama proposal to close off a ridiculous tax loophole that has let them pay only 15% of their lavish income in taxes rather than the 35% rate that us commoners pay. One of the richest of the ragers, Stephen Schwarzman of the Blackstone Group, sees Obama's proposal as an outrageous intrusion into the suites of the elite, comparing it to, quote, when Hitler invaded Poland. This over-the-top tantrum from a multi-billionaire, a guy who spent $3 million in 2007 to throw himself a birthday party. Come on, Steve, pay your taxes. Pathetically, the real root of this sad, sad hedge fund rebellion is a feeling by these powerful, super-privileged megalomaniacs that they are being picked on. One even whined that asking hedge funders to pay taxes at the same rate as everyone else amounts to, quote, the persecution of the minority. This is Jim Hightower saying, good grief, man, get a grip. Next thing you know, they'll hire Glenn Beck to host a weepy telethon to save the billionaire's tax loophole.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
This is the new WHFR Journal, and it is Friday, October 2010. And really want to thank our guest for today. First time that he was in the studio, great friend of WHFR, Ishmael Ahmed, the director of the Michigan Department of Human Services. And there are many, and take advantage of them as long as the budget is still there and holds. He will be leaving that office and getting a new position of sort of community projects, community relations over at University of Michigan Dearborn in January. So we look forward to having him back in the area and doing his magic to get things, good things going here. We're turning now to a movie that's opening today in the Detroit area, but is open in several other cities, causing quite a stir nationally, and we'd like to put some local spin on this. Waiting for Superman, and that's Superman in quotes, by the way, and they're very careful to do that, and I think I know why, is because even though they did get permission to use some of the old live-action Superman clips from the early 50s. That's when George Reeves dressed up in a, you know, an S T-shirt and was jumping around, and they had strings, that pulled him up and so on, real fakey like. But I know I watched it in the early 50s as a kid. I remember a lot of kids watched that and got I think it was some sort of cereal box promotion. Got their own Superman T-shirt.
Did you?
And then they but they jumped off roofs.
Seriously?
Of their houses and garages. Yeah, TV is very very powerful.
Yeah.
And if you see Superman do it, and then you got
something
the T-shirt,
changed.
Why not? You know.
Wow.
Yeah, there's dumb people everywhere, but the kids are very impressionable. We have to be careful of them. We have to educate them properly. Well, what they mean by this in this documentary feature about education in America, and especially K-12 system, is that a Harlem educator had a childhood belief that a superhero would fix the problems of the ghetto. Okay, that somebody had to come. I mean, it serves it on TV. You know, you got a big problem, and well, before the end of the hour or the end of the movie, a superhero comes and saves the day. And it's got to happen, right? I mean, all this bad stuff, it just can't go on. It can't get worse, can it? Well, yeah, reality is different than, of course, dramatic storytelling on movies. And so, in other words, the movie is a very, very strong stimulus. I saw that at the press reviewing time, press screening on Tuesday. It's at the Main Art Theater in Royal Oak, and I hope it's opening elsewhere in the Detroit area, too. I'm not sure about that today. I think eventually it will. Directed by Davis. It says here Davis. Okay, I thought it was David. But Davis Guggenheim, no relation to the rich Guggenheims, by the way. But he is married to actress Elizabeth Shue, so that's something. Yeah. That's S-H-U-E to his credit.
He could do a
credit.
Lot worse than that.
Yeah. Dennis and I probably. Adventures in Babysitting. It was one of her first movies years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess she was about 20 or something then. But it was a great movie. It was set in Chicago, and they actually filmed it in Toronto, I know. It was so great to see them driving around talking about Chicago. But it's
quote, Hollywood.
In Toronto, yeah. Anyway, he was also on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart last night. So you could go to The Daily Show website and watch that interview with him. Again, his name is Davis Guggenheim. So what is it about? Well, it focuses on, and this is the dramatic or the storytelling part, the real story of five families in desperate educational situations for their kids, all about 10, 12-year-old kids, before they go to a high school. So it's middle school kids before they make the jump to a high school. And in their areas, the parents are savvy enough to know that their high schools are next worst thing to prisons. That they are dropout factories, as it's referred to in the movie, that the kids have almost no hope of graduating, not because the curriculum is so tough, although they are mostly unprepared by their previous schooling for the rigors of high school, but because the educational experience is so bad, so badly organized, and a lot of, I'm sorry to say, bad teachers. And the movie does not present a very positive picture of teacher unions in public schools. Obviously, charter schools don't use unionized teachers, usually. And especially my union, the union right here at Henry Ford Community College and the Dearborn Public Schools, the American Federation of Teachers, that teacher union, there's another one called the NEA, National Education Association. They actually have more teacher unions. My daughter's a NEA member out in Southfield Public Schools. More public schools have NEA as their union than AFT. But somehow the NEA didn't get mentioned in this movie, as if the AFT is the only, and they're only about, I don't know, a small percent of the K-12 systems that they actually represent teachers in. But nonetheless, they came off looking, I thought, quite badly. I know my union is better than that. And I did want to say something that was also reflected in the New York Times review of this movie. Randy Weingarten, a woman, Randy Weingarten is president of the AFT, and also the AFT is the union that organizes Washington, D.C., which is called the worst school district in the United States of America. Okay, they're not a state, folks, but they should become a state, but and they can't govern themselves, really, and they got to be beholden to the Congress, and we know what the Congress does to budgets and that. But nonetheless, getting beyond the statehood issue for Washington, D.C., the city itself is known to have the highest dropout rates, the worst instructional program of anywhere in the United States. The AFT is a union there. But since the movie came out, and I think this is important to mention, the Washington teachers have accepted a breakthrough contract in which Ms. Weingarten herself helped negotiate, and it does link teachers' pay to their performance and makes it easier to fire them for incompetence, which is the criticism. And the movie gave the impression that, oh, the teachers' union is not going to move, not going to do anything. They're refusing improvements. And I, in speaking for the AFT in general, at least locally here, that's not the AFT I know, folks. I think it's an excellent union concerned about the best instruction possible and keeping the best teachers in place, too.
So what you have, obviously, you can speak from a lot of experience here. When you're watching this, were there parts of it that you agreed with and parts that you did not? Or overall, did you think that it was too biased? How did you feel about it?
Yeah, I think the impression to an average person, although I listened to the Craig Folly show on WDET 2 days ago, mm-hmm. he had, since Craig's wife is a teacher, he said his opinions were too strong to mention on the air. Or too biased because his wife's a teacher. Well, folks, I've been a teacher in AFT, so I guess I'm too biased to speak.
No, we need your input.
I would have liked to hear what he had to say, either on behalf of his wife or not. But Amy Miller, who is a producer for Craig there, she went to the press screening also on Tuesday, and she doesn't have any ties directly to educators or education herself, other than the education she had, which was. And she said, I didn't think it was anti-public schools. I didn't think it was anti-teacher unions. I don't know how she got that opinion, because it's clearly not that way. That is the impression people, I think the average person, would walk away with. Amy is perhaps more a critical thinker or better educated, sorry to say this, but than the average person, and so she was watching closely. For example, they point out, they seem to give the impression that charter schools, right. Oh, that's the way to go. Send your kids to charter schools, or, and even though they didn't talk about it much, private schools, which means parochial mm-hmm. schools. Okay, because although there are some schools that are not parochial, not church-tied, they are totally private. I think like in Birmingham, Country Day School. They're not charter schools are where you can be organized in a district, and Dearborn has several, like the one that's run by Sault Ste. Marie.
Oh, yeah.
University.
Yeah. Sure.
Whatever that was called
The Lake Superior State.
Lake Superior State University. Right.
That's a technology school. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. But we have several charter schools, and they actually work with public funding. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you can make a choice for your child to go to the public schools in general or go to one of the charter schools mm-hmm. in the area. But how do you get in? Well, it's by a lottery mm-hmm. everywhere in the country, because an awful lot more people want to send their children to a charter school than to public school, and they must have their reasons, of course, and some charter schools are excellent. But as the movie points out, and I think I didn't see this in any of the reviews, the movie itself says that 80% of charter schools across the United States are underperforming, which means you don't really want to send your child there.
No, and you don't know that until it's too late.
However, of course, public schools, about two-thirds,
right.
66%, are underperforming. So actually, if you look at the whole picture of all the schools in the U.S., public schools are performing better mm-hmm. than charter schools. However, the movie had these five kids that they were focusing on in five different areas. Four of the areas were urban, inner city type, low income
right.
areas.
A logical thing, right?
Desperate social situations and educational resources being very, very scant. And one of them, interestingly, was in Silicon Valley.
No kidding.
Yeah, where they got a bad public school, apparently.
Now, okay. After the economy, yeah, sure.
Yeah, all those computer people out right. of work, even. The sad thing, so all of these parents, or all these five in the story that they've chosen, are trying to get their kids into a charter school, which clearly does have better success rates in those five areas.
Right.
And it's a lottery. And in some cases, there's like 10 openings for 1,000 applicants, or 50 or 200 openings for 2,000 or 3,000 applicants. And the way it's done in every one of those situations that they showed, they have a big meeting in a big auditorium, and they have one of these lottery balls, mm-hmm. and every kid's got a number, you know, and you sit there praying with your parents that you'll be selected. Otherwise, it's like not necessarily 100%, but pretty much you're doomed.
Right.
You're doomed to go to a underperforming school with all kinds of other problems too.
Right. Maybe I mean, your safety
crime,
might be
drugs,
sure, sure.
You know, all kinds of issues. They did spotlight, and rightly so, the Harlem Charter School that is doing such a fine job. It's been on TV a number of times, and in fact, I mistakenly was telling people to go see this movie because it showed what a great educational system Canada has.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Canada and Finland are at the top of education in the world. But the movie didn't talk about other foreign countries' education systems, just pointed out how we're way down the list in almost every category. It's certainly not in the top 10 and usually not even in the top 20, depending on which, you know, science or math or whatever. But in fact, it's most of the movie is commented on, and we see and we get comments from Jeffrey Canada. He is the Harlem educator in charge of this huge school that's been so successful in Harlem. It takes the kids once they pass the lottery and get in, and they almost guarantee they're going to graduate. They work with the parents, like the social services here in Michigan that Ishmael was talking about and trying to get in place everywhere. They will work with those parents. They will follow the kids all the way through college, in fact, to make sure they succeed. They have a near 100% graduation rate. In the Detroit public schools, I think it's along 70%, 60 to 70% are there by the senior year. So they lose 40% along the way for whatever reasons. So they don't even have a high school education. Now, I knew in 64 when I graduated from high school that you were pretty much doomed if you didn't. Well, what about today, 45 years later? You're really doomed with all the high-tech jobs. And I talked to a woman, Henry Ford Community College, in charge of the medical assistance programs, that is, assisting a doctor in the office, that they need people in that specific career. And we train them for that here in one of our health careers programs. And she was, so I actually asked, what's the entry level for it? Well, they have to take a typing test. Well, keyboarding. They have to know computers. They can't even get into the program unless they have pretty advanced computer-based skills. And, you know, ultimately later, they're working in the doctor's office with charts and graphs, but entering, data entering, sure, all this too, besides giving shots and blood pressure and so on in those offices. And there's not any career, including telecommunications here. A lot of students who take our staff training class are amazed. I got to learn the computer.
Yeah.
I got to learn how to record on the computer. I got to know what a digital meter is. And yeah, right. Yeah, that's
only
true.
Only if you want to pass.
So you're oh so doomed if you don't get a high school degree. And you probably are pretty well doomed if you don't get a college degree. But I know there's, oh my God. So I've gone on far too long on that myself. But that's my thought, is that in general, public schools are doing better with their unions and their teachers with tenure than most charter schools. But thank goodness we have some charter schools doing so well in these areas. But something like only 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 get the chance to go to them, and the rest are doomed. And this is parents that know enough to apply, parents that really want their kids to be there. And so I was crying at the end of the movie.
Really?
I mean, and that's good. Get people's emotions going.
I'm kind of glad I didn't go with
and
it.
Let's
well, that
talk.
Answered my question.
I had a Kleenex. Thanks, Dave.
Well, it did really answer my question of whether, you know, you came out with any sense of hopefulness. You know, were there compared? You mentioned Canada. Yeah, that's
There's hope, but there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Nobody else is going to do it for us. And there's waitingforsuperman.com website.
Right.
If you want to go explore, he's got a list of 10 things you can do locally, right? You can make a difference locally. And it's not as, in fact, I think John Stewart made a joke about that. It's not as simple as just going and walking into your local school and saying, I want to do something, you know. I won't go to John's joke. It was kind of off the wall. But, you know, you have to be trained, and you have to be fit into the appropriate place in the school. But you can volunteer at your local school. You can get involved with all kinds of community issues that affect your schools. And you can get informed about the best things that are happening. I know most parents don't, and that's where the problem comes in. I do think that these issues about tenure and getting the worst teachers out, and And, you know, there's a problem with just saying, oh, let the principal fire anybody he wants to. Yeah, well, is that a good principal? I mean, what does that principal know about anything? Were they formerly master teachers before they became principal? I mean, do they know the subject area of the person that they're failing or are trying to fire? So there's systemic problems if you put in place, oh, the administrators have a right to fire anyone they want to. I know the unions don't want that to happen, but even among the teachers, and in fact, here at Henry Ford Community College, if there are teachers that are having serious problems in the classroom, whatever the reasons are, they can be identified by a system that our AFT union has put in place in the contract. We suggested it. And so we monitor our own teachers, and we're the first line of defense for the students with bad teachers here. And we can have significant impact. Now, it's all fair, and nobody is dumped on without evidence and facts. But I know when I was department head here in the last millennia, had problems, not in telecom, of course, but problems in related areas that I was over, that drug abuse problems. And it can happen to anybody. It was one of those pain pill things, you know, back problems. Oh, sure. And escalated. And The teacher refused to get help. I said, your students have been saying they're having problems with your teaching and your instruction, and who are you to tell me anything? Well, I'm your department head. You can't fire me. I got tenure. You threw it right in my face, mm-hmm. You know. And in those days, couldn't do a thing about it, although finally what happened, I mean, just sure the college was sponsoring me in those days, the academic dean signed up officially and took one of this teacher's classes so he could be there every day.
That's
impressive.
And
that's
marked down impressive. Exactly what he saw every day. And after a whole semester of bad instruction in this class, he had evidence enough to go to the Board of Trustees and get this person put on suspension. And they didn't have any programs in place at the time. It was like 20 years ago.
Right.
And to try to get this person help.
Right.
And getting off the drug dependency and
sure.
Getting clean in this case. But there's all kinds of reasons why a teacher might become.
The academic or dean.
Is bad. Yeah, that was the only answer.
Huh.
He said, well, you go sit in, Jay. And I said, well, I'd have to sit in every day. It doesn't happen every day. I have a full load of classes.
Sure.
As the department head, I had no time.
Right.
I think I was running the radio station or getting ready to, too. And
no
and
kidding.
The whole program, you know.
Did the dean pass?
I think he got a passing grade because the dean. But
you know, you're talking from your perspective. You know that in this wonderful article in the Press and Guide by Katie mm-hmm. Hetrick, she
yes.
talks a little bit about the American.
That's this week, folks. Wednesday's edition.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. The response from Chris Cipperly, who's the president of the Dearborn Federation of Teachers,
yeah.
This is a direct quote, mm-hmm. In that movie, meaning Waiting for Superman, they completely trash public education and teachers and unions. And Cipperly noted there are millions of students in public schools across the country, and most do very well. Go ahead.
And that's true, but this is the focus on the ones that are getting left behind, and that'll never.
And I have totally appreciate the response. Dearborn Schools. This whole article is about showcasing their programs. They went out, and this particular they called it a PR battle. Mm-hmm. This was on Monday, and you said the movie came out on Tuesday, right?
Well, was here. The movie's been in L.A. and New York other cities for about 2 weeks now.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, so this was their, according to the article, the PR rebuttal or battle.
Right. It's sort of a preemptive strike, pardon the expression, in this case appropriate, I guess, because they knew the movie would be starting to show in Detroit this Friday today.
Now, I don't want to go into the whole article. I mean, we don't have time, but please give it a look. Katie Hetrick, it came out this past Wednesday, and it talks a lot. There's this was almost like they call it a tour. Dearborn High School showed off its best, and they had a lot of different things going on with the Business Professionals of America. It's awesome.
Well, and here's the upside to that. And because my daughter went through Dearborn Schools, there's a lot of things I could say negative about the Dearborn Schools and the system itself. That is federal government, state regulation, and the problems with no child left behind.
Right.
It's almost every child left behind right now because of inadequate funding. The presidents, despite Clinton, Bush, all of them said, "Oh, we want to be the education president," and even Obama too. Well. In fact, the movie makes a point. We've got to have national standards so that all the states aren't fighting one another about what should be taught, what are the goals appropriate, at least for the country as a whole. If you're going to teach American history, you should teach it
Uniformly. Sure.
Yeah. And you could have educators from all around the country setting it up. You don't, well, the government, the socialists, they're going to tell us what to teach.
You're right.
You know, but you need those consistent standards. Right now, it's a total mess. I have friends who are teachers in Austin, Texas. It's an absolute mess. The system is almost chaotic in most of these cities. And my daughter has no special training in special ed. She's got over 40 students, and over half of them are special ed. Not just special ed. You might say, oh, they need a little help with their reading or writing. They are EI. Or something like that.
I don't know what that is.
It's impaired.
Emotionally impaired.
Emotionally. Oh, got it. Okay.
Which means physically violent most of the time.
Okay.
Outbreaks, outbursts.
Okay.
Oh, and she has no help, no assistance, no budget for those, all gone. My friend who's a teacher, certified by Wayne State University, by the way, in teaching special ed, she's doing all special ed in Austin, but she has now 5 assistants. In her classroom of 16.
Yeah.
It's still a chaos. They're still fighting for budget. They still have standards imposed on them that they can't meet without additional resources. And so I'd say, the whole public school system across the country is in desperate straits. Funding is one issue. Overcrowded classrooms. This movie does say we have to have smaller classrooms.
Sure.
Most charter schools have smaller classroom sizes. One teacher for, say, 20 instead of one teacher for 35. But the real answer is the best teachers, consistent goals and standards, and even let's empower the teachers. I guess I shouldn't mention this, but even my daughter said she'd give like a third of her salary for competent professionals if she could just hire them herself.
Mm.
Just so because she can't do anything with all these people out of control. I'm sorry, EI, but she can't do anything more than just try to keep them from injuring one another.
Sure.
And pass them, you know, at the end of the day. She is so frustrated because she's a good teacher in science certified, and she's the best science teacher they got because she's the last one in her middle school in Southfield. They fired all the others, and she can't do her job effectively. And she is one of the brightest kids I know. By the way, the movie was also against tracking. That is where in middle school and high school, they say, oh, you're a dummy. You're going to go in voc ed. You're going to learn stenography or something. Or you're going to go and build heating cooling things.
But like
you're
profiling.
Not college prep.
Right.
And my daughter in Dearborn here, I didn't discover this until 10th grade. She was on the dummy track.
Really?
As the teachers even called it in Dearborn.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her teachers, God bless them, math teacher, said, you're smarter than this.
Right.
I'm going to get you out of this. And my daughter was saying, well, yeah, I'm not doing well in my classes because I've got a bunch of dummy teachers. I actually, for a parent-teacher night, I sat in on one of the classes with this one teacher. Talk about a dummy. I knew more from my high school algebra than this guy did. I mean, he was... And he retired the next year, thank God. But she was already, you might say, damaged for a whole year with this guy. And she got into the college prep track. But she was misplaced for 3 years, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th. And she finally got in the college track, 11th grade. And then she started learning because she loves learning. If she's got a good teacher that's going to provide that stimulus.
And have the expectation.
Yeah. So the most of the charter schools that they showed... They're doing this great job. There's no tracking. Everybody takes the same classes all the way through. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Which means, guess what? At Dearborn High School, you don't have that media class where you can work in the TV studio. Real question here. Do students really need that, or do they need the best science and math and literature and communication skills? Do they need the special things that the AFT showcased at Dearborn High? It's great to have it.
It's a really good question.
When I went through high school... My high school was, I was valedictorian, I was smart, and I always did my assignments in 5 minutes for the next day in class because that's how quick and smart I was. But I was bored to tears. I used to